The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention. For the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Please be seated. All right, we'll begin with United States versus Thompson. Ms. Leaston, is it? We're glad to hear from you.
May it please the Court, Jenny Leaston on behalf of the appellate Shantana Thompson. Your Honors, a crime that can be committed with less than recklessness is not a crime of violence under the sentencing guidelines. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about the force clause or the enumerated offenses clause or, as we'll be discussing today, the residual clause. In all of its filings, in these voluminous filings, the government has not identified a single case by any court anywhere applying any clause that holds that a crime that can be committed with less than recklessness is a crime of violence. And of course, this court has already specifically held in cases such as Martin and Roseboro and Rivers and Peterson and Vinson and Garcia and on, that crimes that can be committed with less than recklessness do not qualify as crimes of violence. The Sentencing Commission itself has indicated that to qualify as a crime of violence, the offense in question should be purposeful. On August 1st, 2016, the Sentencing Commission amended the crime of violence definition and removed the residual clause. But they didn't do just that. They revised the enumerated offenses, and one of the enumerated offenses that they revised was manslaughter. They removed manslaughter and revised it to put voluntary manslaughter. And the Sentencing Commission explained that they did this because involuntary manslaughter would not qualify.
Well, I'm just not sure that, I'm not sure that the government would take issue with that, but let's assume that you're right, that it requires at least recklessness. The government's argument, as I understand, is not with that general proposition, but when you look at the North Carolina statute, it reflects at least recklessness or intentionality.
I disagree, Your Honor. The North Carolina courts have specifically said that North Carolina assaults can be committed through culpable negligence, through such offenses such as a drunk driving accident or the mishandling of a firearm.
Well, I guess you're not disagreeing that it can be an either-or proposition. It can be committed recklessly, but it can be committed with some intent less than that.
Absolutely.
And that's the point, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And so because North Carolina assault broadly encompasses these different levels of intent, including culpable negligence, which this court in Peterson and in Benson specifically said is less than recklessness, then the statute itself is overly broad, and so it doesn't meet the purposeful standard under Begay, which is the threshold inquiry in the case under the residual clause. Now, the government is taking issue with the ordinary case approach and saying that, well, it doesn't matter if some North Carolina assaults can be committed through negligent or reckless conduct. The fact is that most of them are committed intentionally. And so it does fall under the ordinary case approach because the typical case is committed intentionally or intentionally, excuse me. But that argument...
As a practical matter, is it likely that when you look at the North Carolina statute, that serious bodily injury it's defined here as permanent disfigurement, coma, permanent or protracted condition that causes an extreme pain. As a practical matter, how likely is it that those kinds of injuries would be negligently inflicted?
Well, Your Honor, of course, it doesn't matter the degree of injury. The court in Begay said that even if the negligent homicide is not going to qualify under the residual clause, even though there's a 100% chance
of
an injury.
Of course it matters as to the degree of injury, because the greater the degree of injury, the less the likelihood that there would be any negligent infliction.
Well, a drunk driving accident could result in very serious injuries, Your Honor. And, of course, in State v. Jones, the Supreme Court of North Carolina recognized that assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury can be committed through drunk driving accidents, or we also have mishandling of firearms. Now, I agree with you that probably most North Carolina assaults are committed intentionally, but this court has specifically rejected the idea that under the residual clause, you're going to do this sort of measuring, and you're only going to look at to see whether most of them are committed in the ordinary case intentionally. The first time
well,
this
course,
court...
Of course, under Duenas-Alvarez, we do have to look at what most crimes are committed, because what that case is that you have to take a common-sense approach, and you have to look at what actually is happening. And even if something is theoretically possible, it has to be actually somewhat likely.
So two responses to that, Your Honor. First, the categorical approach, which is what we have to apply here, is not taking in it's not a common sense inquiry under the categorical approach. And second, we, unlike many other defendants in Burns-Johnson and Reed and Doctor and several other cases before this court, we're not relying on our legal imagination here. We're not indulging in hypothetical scenarios. We're looking at North Carolina case law and looking at North Carolina cases in which real people have been convicted of assault inflicting serious bodily injury based on no more than negligent conduct. We have, for example, the case of Mitchum v. Gaskell, which involved a man picking up a gun that he thought was unloaded, and then the gun accidentally discharges. And the jury specifically rejected a theory of intent and said that this was negligent conduct. That was specifically assault inflicting serious...
Is there any species of assault in North Carolina that's a crime of violence?
Your Honor, so this court... I believe so. I believe so.
What
I think
that?
There are different. I believe there may be different, and I haven't looked into may be assaults that have a specific intent.
Well, no, I'm asking you if there is a species of assault in North Carolina law that you would say is actually a crime of violence.
Your Honor, I haven't fully investigated that.
Well, the answer is no.
Your Honor, this court in it
was assault by strangulation. The court found that was an assault, a crime of violence,
because it required specific intent. And there also recently, this court in an unpublished decision said that assault inflicting serious injury with intent to kill, which requires a specific intent, would qualify. So
I just find it unusual that a state's code would have this lacuna. To the extent that no species of assault, even the most aggravated species of assault, could possibly be categorically a crime of violence. I haven't come across that, and it seems an odd thing for the North Carolina legislature to have intended. In other words, all of these crimes, whether it be robbery or whether it be assault, they have an ordinary variety, ordinarily punished by misdemeanor or what have you, and then they have an aggravated variety. And I thought that kind of a plausible line we were drawing on these crimes such as robbery and assault was between the sort of normal variety, which is not a crime of violence, and the aggravated variety, which was, and the guidelines, the sentencing guidelines, the commentary to the sentencing guidelines would seem to indicate that the aggravated variety, as opposed to the normal variety, was indeed a crime of violence.
Well, North Carolina certainly is unusual, Your Honor. I agree with you that it's so broadly...
Is there any other state that we can say that no variety of assault, no matter how, Because in Johnson, what they were concerned about was having a nominal touching or something be a battery crime of violence. They would come a long way, I guess, from that.
But I thought you acknowledged that there were North Carolina assaults that were crimes of violence.
I do think that some right. particular ones so will qualify, but not this one.
This is the problem that I'm trying to wrestle with, and I would appreciate your help with. And that is that we know from recent Supreme Court law that we apply the ordinary case analysis to determine the degree of risk, mm-hmm. right?
Correct.
Why would we not do it when we're also determining whether it's similar in kind? I mean, it seems just very odd to me to use a different kind of analysis. Well, maybe your answer is, well, we can do it, and I still win. But if your answer is don't do that, tell me why.
No, my answer is not. I'm not saying that the ordinary case approach does not apply to the Big A analysis here. I'm simply saying that this court has twice rejected the notion that you would look to all of the crimes broadly and say, well, because simply most of them are committed intentionally.
I mean, it seems to me that we're dueling with words then. Most, if most of them do
the
something, then the ordinary one would do okay. something.
So in Roseboro, Your Honor, this court looked at South Carolina's blue light statute, running away, evading a police officer. The government made this exact argument. It said that because most of the South Carolina violations are intentional, then the ordinary case must be that they are intentional and fall under that. And this court specifically rejected that argument and said, no, you have to look to the subset of, if you know that the crime can be committed without purposeful conduct, you have to look to the subset of ones that can be committed negligently and then determine whether though that is a purposeful crime. Now, Judge Niemeyer dissented on that very point. He disagreed with that analysis.
But how long ago was that case? I mean, the Supreme Court keeps changing the the rules here, if you will.
This argument was made again in Martin, Your Honor, in 2014, and Judge Diaz was on that panel. And this was also the government's argument and the topic of the dissent in Martin, was that just because the court didn't look at to whether fourth-degree burglary in Maryland, whether most of them were committed intentionally, because some of them could be committed negligently, they did not cast
well, that's
the
what
I just,
purposeful
that's, inquiry.
That's where I started out with you. Mm-hmm. If we use what the most recent Supreme Court has told us to do, which is to use the ordinary case, if we do that with respect to degree of risk, why don't we do it with respect to similar in kind?
You do do
now,
it.
That is, I don't buy the government's argument that the recent Supreme Court case overruled Martin, but it seems to me that if Martin's decided today, it has to be decided with that in mind.
And both Martin and Roseboro absolutely applied the ordinary case approach to both of those. In fact, they applied that test.
Of the degree of risk
to the ordinary case approach to the similar in kind. Approach. They absolutely applied that.
Okay, but what
approach.
About to the degree of risk?
They actually found that the degree of risk passed the degree of risk.
It seemed to me that that Martin applied it to the degree of risk, but not to the similar in kind. It went to a wholly different analysis.
It went to...
Which, I mean, maybe that is what we're supposed to do, but I'm asking you, I don't think that's what Martin did, and you're saying it did, and that's your response. Is that what you're saying to me?
That was specifically the point of the dissent. That was
well,
in
the dissent. The majority opinion.
I think that's the approach taken by all the courts, Your Honor, in the United States. The threshold inquiry is whether or not the crime is purposeful.
But most of the courts in the United States, most of the circuits, don't follow that particular skew in Begay. We're by ourselves there. I mean, maybe correctly. They seem to think that subsequent cases have moderated Begay, if you will. Do you disagree with that? I mean, there are a whole raft of cases.
I have been unable to find any case under applying Begay to which a court has found that a crime of less than recklessness would qualify under the residual clause under the Begay analysis.
The government's contending here that this is an intent statute, and they cite the two cases of Shannon Williams and Nathaniel Williams. They talk about an intentional assault on another person, and in fact, several, and there are some other North Carolina Court of Appeals cases that describe the offense as an intentional assault. I'm just wondering, in addition, just in terms of likelihood, how likely is it that this, that the kinds of permanent disfigurements, coma, extreme pain, loss of function of any bodily member or organ, how likely is it simply as a practical matter that that's going to be committed negligently?
My time has expired, Your Honor. May I answer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that intent, of course, can be implied through culpable negligence, and as a practical matter, that those sort of injuries can be committed through just as easily through negligent behavior as through intentional behavior, such as a drunk driving or mishandling of firearms, which North Carolina case law clearly shows. We have examples of those in North Carolina case law.
The drunk driving situation seem to be, you know, they're a particular genre of their own and seem to be handled through separate provisions of the criminal code, are they not?
No, Your Honor. North Carolina drivers can be charged with assault for drunk driving.
What's your leading case?
State v. Jones, Your Honor, where the defendant was involved in a drunk driving accident and was charged not only with assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury, but also first-degree murder.
Would be charged under 1432A?
No, Your Honor, but there would be nothing to prevent the state.
Well, I'm not asking you whether there's anything to prevent it or not. What I'm suggesting is that you've got a number of North Carolina cases describing this as an intentional assault on another person. And when I asked you what your leading case was that showed this could be inflicted through criminal negligence, the most you could give me was a theoretical possibility of a drunk driving accident, and then we started talking about it, and I was asking you whether your leading cases involved people that were charged under 14-32A, and the answer to my question was no. And what I'm looking for in terms of a realistic approach to this problem is a cases where this provision has been applied by the North Carolina courts to convict someone on a theory of less than recklessness and negligence. Now, I haven't heard that. You've been up here for 20 minutes, and I haven't heard that case yet.
Do you have that case?
Specifically for assault inflicting serious bodily injury, we have the case of Mitchum v. Gaskell, which involved the mishandling accidental discharge of a firearm, where the jury specifically found that the conduct was only negligent.
That was a charge under 1432A?
Yes, Your Honor.
How many of those are there?
Specifically of that offense. Your Honor, it's obviously it's very difficult sometimes to... What we can only do at this point is look at what North Carolina case law shows us and tells us. There are, of course, thousands and thousands of cases going on in the North Carolina Superior Courts. You get a very skewed view of when you only look at appellate cases because, of course, they are naturally very limited in number.
Well, I understand a skewed view. That's thrown off all the time when people come up with cases and they say, well, there are all these... So there are all these cases in the primary courts of record. They just haven't been reported yet. But that's, you know, that's I wish the answer were more concrete than that, because what, in the absence of much, if any, case law, you can get some guidance from the, I mean, there are North Carolina cases that describe this as an intentional crime. They exist. And they're from the North Carolina courts, and they describe it as an intentional crime.
That can be inferred through culpable negligence.
But when you combine that North Carolina case law with the wording of the statute, and you ask yourself commonsensically, as opposed to theoretically, how likely is it that negligent behavior is going to result in the protracted loss of impairment of any bodily member or permanent disfigurement or a coma or whatever, you come to the conclusion that, yes, it theoretically could be done that way, but in the ordinary case, no.
And, Your Honor, we would just say we have cited many cases in our briefs. These are real people. If Mr. Gaskell comes into federal court, if he is found with a gun tomorrow and is charged with a 922G offense, he will come into federal court tomorrow and he will face the exact same sentencing enhancement as Mr. Thompson based on an assault that was only negligent. Your Honors, I know my time is
hard. I'm trying to read your discussion of Mitchum versus Gaskell in your brief as you're talking. It's never a good thing to do, but anyway, I am trying to do that. And I noticed at least part of it was a civil action. Was there a criminal action first?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Gaskell pled guilty to assault inflicting serious bodily injury, and he did receive an active sentence. And when he tried to get relief from that sentence and from that conviction on the basis that the assault was only negligent, he was told that, no, assaults are intentional, but that the intent can be inferred through culpable negligence.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
When we talk about criminal negligence, as opposed to just ordinary negligence, but we talk about criminal negligence, don't we get into the territory of, I think that we're letting labels guide us a little too much here about, oh, this could be committed by criminal negligence. But criminal negligence is sort of different from your ordinary car accident or what have you. Criminal negligence is really on a par with recklessness. And it manifests an indifference to risk. And that's where we get back into voisin territory. And so you can't really resolve this by fastening on the label criminal negligence, because that's, as an aggravated assault statute implies, criminal negligence is something different from just a mistake. It really is, in point of fact, recklessness, and it really does involve the very thing that the Supreme Court was concerned about in voisin, which was the purposeful and reckless indifference to risk, which I would submit to you, someone that goes and gets completely loaded and drunk, that might be seen as an indifference to risk. When you go on the road and you're plastered, you know the risk. And so I just wonder whether, in reality, given the North Carolina cases, given the language of this statute, whether we can just part the seas and have this stark dividing line based on some label we've slapped to it, when in reality we're talking about the very thing the Supreme Court was and wasn't.
I think Your Honor understands our point exactly. And to further on that, North Carolina has said precisely what the difference between ordinary negligence and culpable negligence is, and it matches almost word for word with Voisin. What the North Carolina Supreme Court has said is that ordinary negligence is based on the theory that the person charged with the conduct should have known the consequences, whereas culpable negligence rests on the assumption that he knew the probable consequences but was intentionally, recklessly, or wantonly indifferent to the results. That's the definition. And ordinary negligence is not enough for an assault. You must have culpable negligence.
It sounds like reckless conduct. Is there a difference?
I think there's not. North Carolina doesn't have recklessness as a mens rea. We don't have it. A lot of states, about 35, have adopted a model penal code reckless definition with their mens reas. It makes sense. It's nice and consistent. North Carolina never did that. And that's important because this is North Carolina's recklessness mens rea. I would also note it was adopted. The earliest case I could find on this definition was from the 20s. So we're talking four decades before the model penal code was ever even written. So the fact that they use slightly different words to define these definitions, it's essentially meaningless unless you're going to assume that these people were all in the same room, which they never were. And so the other case that I would commend to the court, and we quoted this in our brief, is State versus Mundy. And this was a case where a person fell asleep while driving, hit someone, was charged with manslaughter for doing so. And the court specifically said, just falling asleep while driving is not culpable negligence. We would need to know, and I'm quoting from it, whether the operator, because of drowsiness, previous tiring activities, or other premonitory symptoms of sleep, became aware of the likelihood of falling asleep, but continued to operate the motor vehicle under circumstances evincing a thoughtless disregard, and so on. So in Voisin, the court talked about, and this is a quote from Voisin, the word use does not demand that the person applying force have the purpose or practical certainty that it will cause harm as compared with the understanding that it is substantially likely to do so. I mean, these are apples to apples right here. This is what
Ruben, can I ask you a question? Do you still think that the similar in kind test has any continuing relevance in light of the legal landscape as we now know it?
In light of the, I'm sorry, the last second.
In light of the legal landscape as we understand it?
I think the Supreme Court came very close in Johnson to just straight up saying
because
that.
Because I'm trying to reconcile this, what you're proposing, with the result in Martin. So mm-hmm. you can help me with that.
I think Johnson helps to clear that up. I think in your concurrence in Martin, Judge Diaz, you really grasped onto the fact that it was unclear after Begay.
I don't know that I grasped onto much of anything other than the fact that it was unclear.
But and the uncertainty was where I was going. That it was really unclear whether Begay would even apply in that case. I think we now know because of Johnson, too, that it wouldn't. Because Johnson 2 says, for starters, it confirms what some folks thought Sykes said, which was that the purposeful, violent, and aggressive test for the residual clause does not even apply to a crime with a mens rea of anything above recklessness. And the burglary crime in Martin was really a strange crime because
right,
it wasn't
just. Right. Well, whether or not it was applied correctly, the analysis was applied correctly in Martin because of what the underlying crime is, does the Martin holding, the Martin analysis, still stand? Now, you say that Supreme Court overruled it in Johnson. I don't think that's true, but maybe, as Judge Diaz was suggesting, the legal landscape has just moved on for some reason. But what we're looking for, since we're just a panel here, is a way to reconcile Martin, which is circuit law, with the holding that you wish. We can't overrule Martin as a panel. So,
Courses
out.
I don't think you have to do that, and I certainly hear what you're saying, Judge Motz, and here would be my response. In 2010, this court in Harmon, which was well before Martin, described the application of the purposeful, violent, and aggressive test and said that it asks, quote, whether the crime typically involves the type of purposeful, violent, and aggressive conduct that would support an inference that this offender would be more dangerous.
Well, Begay itself says that.
I think you should apply Begay and Harmon. To the extent there's a conflict between Harmon and Martin, Harmon would control, because it's the earlier published decision of this court. To the extent that there's a conflict between Begay or Johnson's discussion of Begay and Martin, you would apply Johnson and Begay because they're Supreme Court cases. And to the extent, like
earlier, I understood you trying to make a distinction with respect to the mens rea you were suggesting.
Right.
I was going to, and Judge Motz, I think you suggested you didn't think that was much to rely on. And I think it's stated in our brief, if the court doesn't agree, I don't think you have to go with us on. So one would be that in Martin, you didn't even need to apply Begay, we now know. But even if you say we did need to apply or we can't overrule
Begay
that,
is,
you know, we're stuck with
the
that.
The analysis in Martin is correct.
Then I think what I would note in Martin And my colleague's right that the dissent does point out this problem, but the majority opinion in Martin doesn't actually address what we're debating in this case today, which is, should you expressly apply the ordinary case approach? Should we first determine whether the ordinary case of this crime is purposeful, or do we just throw it out because it's possible to commit it without? And I've read this opinion now so many times. I don't see it as addressing that question. You could say it impliedly just didn't apply that test, but I think it's a lot different than if this court had a holding that said straight out, we don't care if it's possible to commit it not purposefully, then it's out. I don't think this court has a case that says that. But Johnson 2, I think is very clear.
Before you get there, so you would say that even though the case that the appellant cites to us, that we just talked about in great detail in the reply brief, that's the single and only case, and therefore the ordinary case in North Carolina is not covered? Is that what you would say?
I would go further. I am shocked that the defendant wants to talk about Mitchell v. Gaskill because it goes the other way. Uh-huh. There is no case in North Carolina that supports the proposition that assault inflicting serious bodily injury can be committed with culpable negligence. I've read them all. And here's what Mitchum is a fascinating saga, but Mitchum, of course, as you identified, Judge Motz, it's a tort case. It wasn't a criminal case.
But there was an underlying criminal case.
Which he had pled guilty to, so there was no issue about his mens rea in that case. And in the now, this was a case where Mitchum was suing over what he claimed was an intentional assault. It was a heated argument. It wasn't an accidental discharge. At
so
least
you're
that
saying
was the
there's
debate.
No case anywhere that has applied a culpable negligence theory?
To this crime, not that I have found.
To this particular crime.
In North Carolina. But you finish up telling me about this case?
Sure. Sure. I would commend to the court, it's a fascinating
Don't worry, we'll read it. But
it's great. So Gaskill was arguing that he intentionally shot Mitchum in self-defense. He needed to make a self-defense claim. He needed it to be intentional. And so he wanted to rely on his conviction for AISBI in order to prove intent. Judge wouldn't let him do it. He failed to preserve that issue on appeal. It didn't get addressed. I believe he may have tried in a habeas proceeding to challenge the intent for his guilty plea, but the court wouldn't really address that issue either. But what happened next is what's most fascinating. So Gaskill decides he wants to get the money from his insurance company for the tort suit. And Nationwide, in this case, we cited it in our brief, Nationwide Mutual Insurance v. Gaskill. It's at 626 Southeast 2nd, 876, where the Nationwide Insurance said, we're not paying. You have a provision in your policy that excludes intentional conduct. It was AISBI. And the North Carolina Court of Appeals said, that's correct. This is an intentional crime. That's why I'm shocked that the defendant wants to talk about that case. And if that's the case for the defendant to hang his hat on as the example of culpable negligence for this crime, we'll take it, because I've read all of the other ones, and I want to back up and say to you what I was going to start with, good morning, and say, may it please the court, you know, this crime in North Carolina, assault inflicting serious bodily injury, this is the crime that they charge when you beat someone to within an inch of their life. And I mentioned earlier, I've read all these cases. I read it originally to see if you could commit this crime with culpable negligence, and I didn't find any. I have a giant Excel spreadsheet of all these cases, and I didn't find any. But, you know, I also learned that this crime is just unquestionably
menacing. Well, you're making an argument in the alternative, aren't you? Because you're saying that there aren't any North Carolina cases finding this under a theory or convicting under a theory of culpable negligence. But I also understood you to say that culpable negligence is a level above just ordinary negligence.
I'm making both of those arguments. So
you're making them both.
And the reason is, Your Honor, the implications of this case, it may not on its face appear, but they're huge. And they're huge because this court will have the opportunity to decide if Voisin applies across the circuit to the force clause, and that's a major important question right now.
Well, let me ask you this. In your briefing, you seem to indicate one of sort of three different theories under which we could find it a crime of violence. One, that aggravated assault was actually listed in the commentary. And then the second theory was that it satisfied the force clause because you couldn't cause permanent disfigurement, coma, etc., without at least the application of physical force against the person of another.
That's correct.
And then the third argument was under the residual clause in 4B1, which, of course, hinges on the serious risk language. But I understand that's been repealed in the ACCA, so you know, who knows what its fate is going to be in the under 4B1. But which of these, she says that these all these theories don't matter because at the end of the road, you're allowing people to be convicted on negligence. You've, I think, done a good job in rebutting that. But what is your, you've got all these different theories, the enumerated offense, force clause, residual clause. Mm-hmm. So just straightforwardly, though, what is your clinching theory?
We think we went on all of them, but the one I would recommend to you to decide this
you think you went on all,
is the
okay.
force clause. And the reason that I say that, and the reason it's so incredibly important, and this case has such broad implications, you could hold that this particular assault can't be committed with culpable negligence, and that'll answer this case. But if you decide that this crime cannot qualify, all of the other assaults, potentially with the exception of the ones with intent to kill, will fall. And I do want to make clear, because my colleague suggested that perhaps the ones with intent to kill don't count. The federal public defender for the Eastern District of North Carolina is making the argument right now in our courts, and I believe in this court, that those crimes don't count under this exact same
argument. Well, they can make the argument, but it's a horse, I mean, it's a different case altogether, right?
But I think your decision in this case will directly...
Well, we've been able to parse out the various assault crimes in North Carolina. Doctor was an exception to the general rule, right? So we can distinguish.
There will be a few, and we do think the ones with intent to kill have a specific intent requirement that kind of changes the whole inquiry. But to be clear, North Carolina has about 35 different assault crimes, and most of them, under this reasoning, would be out. Assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury. Assault on a law enforcement officer. Assault on a handicapped person. They're all going to follow the same argument made here. So this case has a dramatic effect. And to turn to the force clause, with my remaining time, the Supreme Court in Voisin talked about what it means to use force. And they said, use is the word that we care about. It's the only one we're analyzing here, is the word use. And they made crystal clear that you don't have to intend the conduct in order to use force. All you need to do is be aware of the risk when you undertake the act. The Fifth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and the Tenth Circuit have all applied Voisin beyond the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence provision that was at issue in Voisin. And the Fifth Circuit went even further to explain that post-Voisin, guidelines provisions using the language has as an element the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another are indifferent to mens rea. We concern ourselves only with whether Mendez's predicate conduct was volitional. That's the Fifth Circuit and Mendez-Henriquez. And I would note that in order to get there, the Fifth Circuit had to rule that Voisin superseded an en banc decision of that court. This court has actually already answered. So one of the questions, there's three things I've got to convince you of. The first one is that Voisin applies beyond the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence provision. And as I'll explain, I think that's actually already settled by circuit, at least by where the law is at this point. The second is that it applies over prior case law of this court, and I'll talk about that. And the third is that it applies, even though this crime isn't listed as recklessness, it applies because culpable negligence is functionally the equivalent and it requires both Voisin and
Voisin. Let me ask you this. Is your force clause argument that you could not inflict serious bodily injury with a coma and a protracted condition that causes pain and the rest, that you couldn't inflict those without at least the application or the attempted use or threatened use of force against another?
I think it's a little different than that. I don't necessarily disagree with it, but what we're saying is, so the inquiry for the text of the
force
clause...
Are you saying that is your force clause argument that it simply involves a serious risk?
No, it's the use of force, Your Honor. And the key, the force clause doesn't talk about risk. It talks about the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another. So the defendant's argument is, because you can, which we dispute, but because you can commit this crime with culpable negligence, it's not a use of force. It's not a use if you... they say accidentally hit someone. It's not using force. And that's why Voisin is so important, because Voisin answered that question and said, you don't have to intend the force in order to use it. So what we say is, in all of these violent assaults, not just this one, but assault with a deadly weapon, etc., they involve the use of force because they have to be committed with either actual intent, which is a use of force, or a volitional act undertaken with awareness of the risk, which is also a use of force. Either way, you're using force, and that is what the text. Any good analysis begins with the text. And as I look at the text of this guideline, I would just note that there is not one word anywhere about mens rea. The force
clause. How are you using the force? Are you using the force intentionally, or are you using the force recklessly, or what?
At a minimum, even if you accept defendant's argument about the characterization of this offense, at a minimum, the least culpable conduct would require you to undertake the action volitionally with awareness of the risk that the injury might occur, the force might be applied.
That's not consistent with Vincent, though, right?
I think, for starters, Vincent is a misdemeanor crime and domestic violence case. So to the extent that conflicts with Voisin, that's a one-to-one Voisin.
But the language was a lot broader than Vincent.
I think what Vincent said, so and to unpack this, we got to go back to Peterson. Because Peterson said that it was not about any of this. It was about comparing North Carolina involuntary manslaughter to the generic crime of manslaughter, which the court determined required a mens rea of recklessness. That was when the court said that culpable negligence is slightly less than recklessness. And so Vincent came along and said, well, at the least, a crime has to involve at least recklessness. I think the court's case law has suggested it has to be more than that in order to be a use of force. All of that came before Voisin. Voisin says a use of force doesn't come down to the mens rea. It comes down to whether you have the understanding it's likely to apply the force, not the knowledge, not the intent, not the purpose. And that is what has led three of the other circuits in this country to adopt that reasoning, apply it. And while I still have...
Do you get any clue from the fact that we scheduled oral argument after Beckles to have you consider the case in light of Beckles and cases that were decided after the original oral argument in this case?
Doesn't that
give you a clue about maybe where we were after the original oral argument?
I take your point, Your Honor, but I'm mindful, Judge Motz, I'm mindful of the fact that in June, after oral argument was calendared in this case, this court said, and I see I'm over my time, may I answer your question, Judge Motz? I'm conscious of what this court said about the exact same word in the misdemeanor crime and domestic violence provision, the word use, in a Supreme Court case, Castleman. The court applied the Supreme Court's decision in Castleman to, in that case, it was ACCA's force clause. And said, to be sure, Castleman did not construe ACCA's force clause, and it expressly reserved the question of whether the causation of bodily injury, a term defined broadly under Tennessee law, would necessitate violent force under Johnson's definition in ACCA. But the court's formal reservation does not foreclose application of the relevant aspects of its reasoning, which did not rest on any distinction between 922G9 and ACCA's force clause. That is subsequently decided authority of this court, that if you follow that case law, Voisin applies here. It must. It was interpreting the same word this court has already said is used interchangeably between the misdemeanor crime and domestic violence provision and the force clause of the guideline, the career offender guideline. So I take the court's questioning about some of these use of force things as an indication that it still may be worth discussing. Perhaps not, but I need to say that.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I would ask that the court not call this categorically violent crime by some other name. Thank you.
Ms. Lisa.
Yes, Your Honor. First, I'd like to point out that Voisin is all about recklessness. It is from beginning to end about recklessness. So even if you agree that the Voisin can be applied to the crime of violence definition, and there is a current circuit split on that issue, and of course we agree with the First Circuit's discussion in Bennett and Windley. It's all about recklessness, and this court has already specifically said in Vinson and in Peterson that North Carolina culpable negligence is less than recklessness. So we would argue that to adopt the government's position, you would have to overrule your decisions in Peterson and in Benson. Because make no mistake, the government's argument about the Forest Clause is going to result in North Carolina involuntary manslaughter also qualifying under the Forest Clause, because the government wants you to apply that. But the Sentencing Commission has already said involuntary manslaughter should not qualify.
Well, maybe so, maybe not. I mean, I'm not sure that there's a parade of horribles.
I would also,
from this, but what you seem to indicate that Voisin had almost no effect, and I think, as my colleague has indicated, the decision did matter because it loosened the connection between the act and the mens rea.
So,
in crime of violence jurisprudence. And that's important.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it did so. The Supreme Court was actually very, very careful to note in footnote 4, we are not saying that our discussion here of recklessness necessarily applies to other force clause provisions. Because, and this is something that Justice Scalia pointed out in the Johnson 1, when he was talking about physical force, he was saying, look, all of these, this use of force in all of these statutes, the context matters. And that's why I would really recommend the First Circuit's discussion of this in Bennett, which I think is very thorough and thoughtful. First of all, in the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence provision, you're talking about a lesser degree of force.
But to come back to Voisin, what Voisin holds is the conduct that involves a real risk of serious injury and indifference to that risk. If you have that, then the force clause is satisfied. Now, the question I have is why this statute doesn't map on to what Voisin was saying. That is, it describes conduct that would, at a minimum, it seems to me, involve a real risk of serious injury. And in fact, the whole statute is entitled Inflicting Serious Injury. And there's a reason that that statute was called what it is. But, and then it defines serious bodily injury. So if Voisin's saying that conduct involving a real risk of serious injury and reckless indifference or purposeful indifference to that risk, the force clause is satisfied. And that seems to me in Voisin, which I think is the most problematic part of your argument of trying to circumnavigate that case, that this statute seems to map on to what Voisin was saying in 922G9 or whatever it was. I don't understand how this serious injury could be inflicted without indifference to the risk of it.
Your Honors, it's a different force clause, and the Supreme Court is talking about recklessness, which this court has already held twice, that North Carolina culpable negligence is less than recklessness. So that's how we don't think Voisin applies to this case at all.
But you've got another problem here, and that is there's just a dearth of actual cases charging under 1432A that it involves a conviction.
And Your Honor,
on negligent grounds, and you've got two arguments to meet in that case. Number one, whether the North Carolina courts would even allow it. And number two, if culpable negligence is the standard, why isn't that above and beyond ordinary negligence and something that maps on to recklessness? So you've got those two different questions facing you.
Your Honor, the reason why the government is so concerned about this assault question is that because North Carolina broadly applies this culpable negligence standard to all sorts of variety of assault offenses, and those we have listed in our brief, different...
That may be, but those are different statutes, and you know, sufficient unto the day. We've got a more limited question before us here, but I do think you have two problems. One is getting around Voisin, which I haven't seen happen, and the other is trying to convince us that this is an ordinary negligence statute or something like that. And I'm not convinced that it's not a recklessness statute, both by the way it's worded and by the North Carolina case law. And those are two pretty significant problems.
And, Your Honor, I think the difficulty with your interpretation is that it is going to require this panel to overrule a number of its previous decisions. We are simply trying to apply faithfully the decisions that this court has made and apply it and faithfully apply North Carolina law, which says that assault can be committed through culpable negligence.
We do have a Supreme Court there for a reason.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll come down and read counsel and move to the next case.